current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha. Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW-Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning and welcome to Education Matters. I'm your host for this week. My name is Mike Kehoe. And with me are Chris Allen, who's the executive director of the Kenosha History Center, and Cynthia Nelson, who's the curator of collections and the archivist there. And I've been looking forward to doing this program for a long time because we tend to get in a rut sometimes, and some people don't think of museums as being educational institutions, and I think they are heart and soul educational institutions and enormous resources. So I'm really pleased with what you folks do in the community. I started doing some volunteering there a couple of years ago, and I've been just delighted with the experience. Cynthia, you've been here longer than any of the three of us in this room.
I'm older than dirt at the museum now, so it's been a very enjoyable experience because when I first came on the museum, I was a Monday only, one day a work person, one day a week person, and it was like they had never cataloged the collections from, 1878,
we were founded, yes.
When we were founded. So think of them, they're starting, the Settlers Club or Settler Society started collecting things at that time period. You know, they were wanted to save their history and their heritage. And in 1985, when Mr. Phil Sanders, who a lot of the people in the community will remember, who was the director of the museum at that time, retired, and they wanted to hire people professionally trained in the field, and they had never cataloged anything that had come into the museum. So I was hired specifically on to do that, and I'm still doing it, and because we're an actively growing collection all the time. And so our mission is to save city and county history in southeastern Wisconsin in the early times. So it is a joy to do. It's also that little bit of burden underneath because we have to predict, we hope to, what people are going to be interested in that 100 and something plus years down the road.
Right. I was thinking of that with the email that you sent me just a day or so ago, Chris, because you have underneath your name, you have preserving the past to inform the future or something like that?
Correct, yeah. Our current mission at the Kenosha County Historical Society, and that's who operates the Kenosha History Center and also the 1866 Southport Light Station Museum, our current mission is to preserve the past to teach the future. So those artifacts that Cindy was just talking about and those artifacts that she's cataloging but also actively collecting, those are the artifacts that help us tell the story about Kenosha County, dating back to when the first Yankee settlers came here in 1835 all the way up until present day. So that is our mission, and that's our current.
I recall a feature article that the Kenosha News ran a couple of Sundays ago having to do with all the new people who have been coming into Kenosha and how the city has been growing west in the last couple of years, and how they, what their experience has been and what the community's experience has been with them assimilating. And a couple of the people that were quoted in there commented on the fact that that the newcomers didn't understand the history of Kenosha. And from my experience working at both of the museums for the last 10 years, a lot of the people in Kenosha don't know a lot about the history of Kenosha. It's a very rich history.
Sure. Yeah, it is absolutely very rich. Again, starting out in 1835 when Yankee settlers came to the shores of Southport, before it was called Kenosha, actually. Kenosha came from the Indian word Kenosia, which was Indian for pike. And they actually called, they called the town Pike Creek prior to them calling it Southport. So for those first 2 years, 1835 to 1837, they referred to this town as the Pike Creek, I believe.
Or it was on the north side where we would know St. Catherine's Commons up by the Bandshell. that was a little village, and then the South Port, or what we know as Kenosha, was a little village, and they were actually the few people that were here were competing to be the growing community in that. Well, what happened eventually is Pike on the inlet by Carthage College disappeared, and then it became then Southport and then Kenosha over time.
And then there are some little places that have been assimilated in Kenosha that almost nobody knows anything about, such as Truesdell.
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. Truesdell for the train line. And then we had the Bain Station for the train line. So a lot of those knowledge of people here, locals even, it's not there any longer.
Well, I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that we were once a part of Racine. There wasn't a Kenosha County. We would have all been known as Racinians. So I think that's first and foremost. We became Kenosha in 1850. So that's one little piece of tidbit.
And that's what we have to save in our collections. We'll say Kenosha, Kenosha County history. However, our history incorporates Racine County, and then even before that, I believe Racine County was actually part of Greater Milwaukee County when it was Wisconsin Territory. And so our collecting statement actually has to be a little broader in the earlier time period. Mm-hmm. It is really interesting. We just had a request come in. Somebody wants to know if there was a Chicago, Wisconsin in Kenosha County, and we don't really know at this point. We haven't found anything, but that's one of those questions that we're going to see if we can answer. Because I have found, working as long as I have at the museum, there are some little villages or little places like the Brass Ball Corners that people know and Kellogg's Corner that people know but have disappeared out of people's memory that are actually places. So we wonder if there's a Chicago in Kenosha County or not.
You know,
there's so many things like that. The tiny cemetery over by Southport School, for example, that people just don't know about. But before we got too far from the subject, Cynthia, one of the things I wanted to get from you, because the time that you've been there and what you commented on, people don't realize that this is not like the other museums, a government-owned operation. This is this has been an effort of interested citizens primarily, and a lot of these groups. You know, have difficulty pulling things together. One of the things I found at Southport is people are at the light station is people are constantly asking me, frequently asking me, "Gee, it's amazing that an organization like the History Center was able to bring about a restoration of something like this, especially in Kenosha, which has a reputation as being kind of careful with its money."
Pretty much from the day I've worked at the museum, because we were the Kenosha County Historical Society located in the Ewell Mansion, and now we're the Kenosha County Historical Society located at the Kenosha History Center, the old Water Department building. They always think we're county government, but we are not part of county government. We're not county employees. We do get a grant budget from the county, but we raise money through people having access to buying images from our archives, with our fundraising events like our chili cook-off that we have every year, our National Lighthouse Day event. So part of that is goodwill and knowledge of the lighthouse station and the tower there. But we own the collections as an organization, as the keepers of things that the public have given us. So we are our own entity as a nonprofit museum. But we are publicly beholden to take care of it properly, but we're not a government department. We are not part of the county of Kenosha. And most people don't know that, and that's a good thing for them to know. We are dependent on the goodwill of the community to help us exist and sustain ourselves.
And as a group like that, it's been amazing the things that you have accomplished. And maybe you could, in somewhat of a encapsulated form, provide for us an overview of some of the things that have been done since Don Shepherd was there. John Shepherd.
I can tell you, our first professional director was a man named Brad Larson. He had gone to Cooperstown, his public history program in New York for his master's. He came here. He was their first paid professional director. He was there for about a 5-year time period. And what they did is they were only open Tuesdays and Thursdays and like the first Sunday of the month. And that was it. And what we've gone now is we're open, you know, 6 days a week. We have archival time periods, gallery time periods, our lighthouse station. So we have brought in our public presence so much from just 2 afternoons a week from 2 to 4 and 1 Sunday a month. So it's remarkable now that we have gone, you know, Tuesday through Friday from 10 to 4:30 and Saturdays and Sundays and seasonally at the lighthouse. So just that improvement really since 1985 is a lot to be said for an organization that is really beholden to themselves to try to expand and have access to the public. Our purpose is to have the public to have access to the opportunities to learn about community history, county history, city history, and that's what third graders all the way back in time have done. But now we're in a handicapped accessible building. Before, you couldn't get to the second floor of my old building, and then the floors weren't connected between the new building and the old building. So handicap accessibility, we see a lot more people. Maybe you're aged out because of accessibility that you can't walk the whole building, but we, even all the generousness of people in the community, we've been given wheelchairs, so if you can get around for part of the time in the building, but you need to get around, there's nothing that's preventing them from seeing our galleries, to accessing things. My library or my archives on the other building, second floor, no way to get up there if you have accessibility uses. Issues. So for me, I love that I have children now who wouldn't have been able to see things on their third grade school tour, can see at our building now. They can get into the lighthouse station with a handicapped accessibility in the back of the building. And we have that at this building. So more hours, more a public face, more events, staffing to professional standards. I love it. I didn't really know if the institution would have that future, and we do. And I'm proud of that. I'm proud of what we've done over the years as the different directors that have come in and the different archivists that come in. And our volunteers, if we didn't have volunteers, and you're putting your time in as a volunteer with us at the Lighthouse Station, we would cease to exist if our volunteers stopped coming in tomorrow.
And your archives, I mean... You're not just an old curiosity shop. You're a place where people can do some research, where people can look things up. People can make contributions to history and learn from history beyond just seeing mustache cups and rocking chairs, was my experience in my home.
And you're a contributor of that. I mean, you have brought us things in from the different, the one publication with the railroads out of the Chicago railroads that you brought in, and we, at this point, we don't have your originals, but we were able to make duplication of the originals so that when people have questions about things related to the railroad in the community, images in the community, we can actually know go to that file that was produced yesterday on some of that material, and now it is accessible for people to answer those questions. So people ask for such a variety. It might be, my grandmother lived on Salem Avenue. What street is Salem Avenue? Because all our street names change. The numbers changed on the streets. They might want to know about a house that they've bought and they want to restore it. There's so many questions that people want to know. And then what's wonderful about those generation of people asking us questions, if we can answer it, that's great. Many times we can't, but then what that generates is conversation about, I have this. It's a photograph of my confirmation class at this particular church. Would you like it? Nobody's going to want this. Is it identified? Is it a date? Are you in it? Yes. Those, we are looking for people's lives, the stories, those images, the materials that tell their stories.
And now with your new building, you're able to do a lot of additional things as far as much more lively, interactive exhibits, and I know Chris, you're really excited about.
Yeah, I mean, you're gonna do there. Yeah, to give a short history of just the Historical Society in general, like Cindy had said, we were founded in 1878, and originally we were in the basement of the county courthouse. So obviously, a very small area down there is more of just storage. Eventually, in the 1960s, we moved over to the Third Avenue Yule Building, and we were able to tell the story of Victorian Kenosha. And you know, being the Kenosha County Historical Society, we would really like to tell all of Kenosha County's history. And when we moved into our current building, the Old Water Treatment Building on Simmons Island, that really allowed for us to tell a lot more of the actual stories from all of Kenosha, not just the Victorian era, but then we can tell the industrial history. We can tell when the settlers came here. It's allowed us to kind of build some buildings. It's reminiscent of Streets of Milwaukee at the Milwaukee Public Museum, our Rambler Gallery, and into our Lineman Gallery as well. But yeah, it allows us a greater avenue to share the stories about all of Kenosha, not just one small segment. And, you know, like I said, in our yesteryear gallery, we tell everything pre-1900. So everything from 1835, when the first settlers came here, up until industrialization. Into our Rambler Gallery, we talk about the industrialization of Kenosha and what businesses were here, what the workers' lives were like. And that's where we do have our nice automobile collection, and or I should say automobile display at this point. And we're able to tell that story. So, you know, just having a bigger facility, but also, like Cindy said, a facility that's handicap accessible, more accessibility to our archives, and then the opportunity to have more artifacts on display, it certainly enhances our mission to preserve the past to teach the future, just because we're able to touch on more segments around the whole community then.
We have actually a wall we can put something up in this building, whereas in the historic home, I had to work around windows. So think about if you're trying to do a museum in your home, if I wanted to go to your house and I wanted to start putting museum displays, just with our industrial history, and we have 4x8 panels, where would you put a 4x8 panel in a historic mansion? So, and what's good about not having those windows to work around is it also doesn't have light to come in, and the temperature changes and the humidity, being along lovely Lake Michigan, Wisconsin has humidity issues. I have a building that I don't have to worry about lights or light coming in through a window. And so having walls and having better control of how you can care for your collections, to have better control of the environment, is a wonderful thing at this new facility. And when we're asking people to yearly change out on our transportation, car exhibits and that, you know, there's a way the automobiles can get into the building, because we have a ramp that was built to bring the autos in the building so that we can have a rotating loan of automobile cars made in our community that people can see.
Yeah, and that's what we really do for our automobile display each year, is we reach out to the community, and we have a story that we would like to tell, and we rely on community members to then bring their automobiles in, and those are all on loan from people around the community. The other interesting thing about our new facility here is the fact that it's adjacent to the 1866 lighthouse. So being the Kenosha County Historical Society and taking care of the lighthouse, and also being in our building there, it's a nice campus that it's set up now. So whereas we were over on 3rd and then we were helping with the lighthouse, now we are in one central location where people can come visit the Kenosha History Center and the Southport Lighthouse and get the complete experience. So we're proud of that.
Well, I liked your comparison of the exhibit on the west end as you come in to the streets of Old Milwaukee, because you really do get that feeling in there, because after you walk up the ramp, you sort of lose the association with the atmosphere that you came in from the street with, and it's quiet in there, and it's dark, and you have the impression of a nighttime sky and evening lighting, and it's really nicely done.
Yeah, and you had mentioned it prior to this. Don Shepard was very influential in setting all of that up, and he is our former director who had just retired at the end of last year. He had been with us for 30 years, and that was one of his things that he was very proud of when we came into this new building and setting up the Yesteryear Gallery.
And there was controversy when we were moving to that building. Some people philosophically, they thought the dioramic sort of exhibit programs for history museums or museums in general was a dying thing, but they didn't really ask visitors, do you like dioramic exhibits, so like the Street of Old Milwaukee, or like Milwaukee Public Museum also has like a jungle Costa Rican sort of rainforest exhibit. And people love that about our program, is the fact that we have dioramic exhibits. Because otherwise, think about it, we could have only cases in there, and cases really limit what kind of story you can tell with your materials. You know, you're going to have shelves, and you have glass and that, whereas we've built little vignettes of businesses like a barber shop and a apothecary drugstore and a one-room school. But I will tell you, there is a secret for that room. We had a limitation in that room because of equipment that was in the room to process the water. So I have small little concrete pads that are actually hidden in that gallery that we had to figure out how to build exhibit design around that. And if you had a case, you would have had to step up onto a concrete platform, and we had to hide it. So Don would say, well, if we build little buildings and that, we can disguise our concrete platform. So that's that creative thinking that Mr. Shepard had about how can we work with that and that building. They're not as tall as they are in our auto museum, which works actually as a riser, and people are less likely to want to get into a car when you have a psychological and physical barrier. So that's one thing, is there's a secret little concrete pads under part of that to slip those displays in that room.
Yeah, and a lot of it goes into, the old Louis Sullivan saying, form follows function. So the reason behind some of our displays is because of functionality, but when we have third graders through our museum, when they visit that area of the museum, they are just, delighted and thrilled that they're almost stepping back in time. And there's, in that diorama room, we have a one-room schoolhouse set up, for instance, and we have a school teacher that's there and with her stick, and it's an interesting way to interpret things and show what a one-room school room would have been like. We have the slates, the slate where people have done the arithmetic. It's just a really neat area of the museum and something that we are definitely proud of. And we couldn't have done any of that without the efforts of Don Shepard, one of our former executive directors here as well.
And what's also wonderful about that gallery is one of the first things they see is this, they call it a wagon, but what it is, it's an ox cart. It's a two-wheeled ox cart that actually came from Connecticut. It would have gone on the Erie Canal. It would have gotten on a masted tall ship, sailing ship, and would have been brought through the Great Lakes from the north of Lake Michigan down to Southport, and then would have had to be taken off a ship and brought to shore in a lighter, which is like a big rowboat for cargo, and brought here. So we know the family it came from. We know the family history. It's their ox cart, and it's been in the collections for a long time. And when they see that and they see how big the wheels are and what things you were limited to bring here but what were essentials, they are just in their time machines, and they love it.
Yeah, it's one thing seeing something in a textbook. It's another thing looking at it and saying, oh, well, this wagon came here in 1837, and that's the year that Upson wagon did come to Southport, and it's just an amazing thing. And, it brings history to life.
You mentioned schools, something I've obviously been very interested in because of my involvement with the schools. In school tours, at your previous facility, you had really no option for doing that. Mm-hmm. And I think you had mentioned to me recently that you were hoping to expand that.
Yeah, we are absolutely looking to expand that. Already we've had school tours scheduled for this year that are outside of our community, which is somewhat of a first for us. But people are interested in Kenosha and Kenosha as a case study, and then also the Southport Light Station Museum. But what we've really done is focused in the past on our third grade curriculum. And in Kenosha, and I think across America, in third grade you learn about your community. So there's a natural tie in there, but what we've come to realize, and we've realized this by talking to teachers around the community, is that the other classrooms and the other grades are interested in our history as well. And there's different ways to take a look at that history and interpret that and fit that into their curriculum depending on the age group as well. So yeah, we are absolutely looking to expand our school tour program. We have availabilities Monday through Friday, and we have a great volunteer staff that's willing to lead schools through our galleries and give them great tours, both at the History Center and at the Southport Light Station Museum. So that's something we're definitely proud of.
Yeah, I would think the schools would definitely be interested in that too, because I know that teachers are always interested in putting a different kind of lesson plan in for a day or so to highlight something that they're dealing with. And these days, budgets being what they are, field trips have been cut back, and out of town field trips and so on are becoming a thing of the past unless the parents are willing to foot the bill for it. And you provide an opportunity for a very educational experience at a much more reasonable expense.
Yeah,
it doesn't involve the transportation and so on.
Absolutely. And I touched on our school trip, the school trips to the Kenosha History Center and the Southport Light Station, but also we run a one-room schoolroom at Hawthorne Hollow. So both in the fall and in the spring, we have 17 classrooms that go out to Hawthorne Hollow, and they do a day in the life of 1906. And we take them through basically what a typical school day would have been like in 1906. We have a school teacher that's dressed up like it's 1906, and that's another wonderful program that we do offer for the Kenosha schools here. So,
that's interesting, because I did not know about that, and I doubt that I think there are a lot of people who don't know that you have that connection with Hawthorne Hollow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that we've been doing.
They had approached us to do it, and we said we could do it for them. So they encouraged the girls to wear, you know, skirts, you know, more modest things for the time period. So the children have to think about what can we put together at home that might be clothing from 1906. They pack a lunch for the day, so there's certain things you can't bring. You know, you can't bring bananas, you can't bring Fritos. You have to think of what kinds of things that you could have in a lunch. And we give the teachers an idea what they should encourage the children to bring. And you're thinking of, you know, those, there's not insulated lunch bags, and there's not juice bottles or juice boxes they can bring in that. So there's something beyond preparation that they have to think of even before they come into the classroom. So if it's a nice day, they have recess outside. Well, what would you do as a recess as an integrated, you know, one-room school? Is it a bad day? Is it a good day? They talk about, you know, water and heating, and so they have a lesson plan for that time. So we try to do an immersion program for them.
Yeah, that I'm trying to remember that school building. That's kind of in an isolated area out in the woods, isn't it?
Yeah,
so
it
really
is.
Feel like you're in a front.
They have to hike to it.
Yeah, they have to hike through the woods. You know, if it's been raining out, you hike through the mud and up through a little clearing in the pathway there. And you really are by yourself. There's no roads in sight. You can't hear, you know, Highway 31 or anything like that. So it does give them a very true experience. It's something that's unique.
As far as the clothing, it was thinking when I was at the Civil War Museum for quite a while, they have sometimes people in character on weekends that they know that there are going to be a lot of folks going through in costume, there was one of the assistant curators or whoever there got a hold of some period clothing, especially children's clothing. And when things weren't too busy, kids could put on those clothes, and maybe their parents could put on their clothes. Mm-hmm. and they could take a picture of themselves and everything. That was immensely popular.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, anytime you have that interaction and engagement, that's what museums are really striving for these days, and that's something that we're striving for ourselves. But it really brings history to life, like I said. It's a lot better than just looking at a photo of someone else wearing it when you can actually put it on yourself and, right. and get a feel for what it would have felt like. I mean,
yeah, bringing it alive. That the kids at these events at the Civil War Museum, the girls would be asking the women about the clothing that they wore and how they spoke and how they interacted with other people, and the boys were doing similar sort of things and
asking about the guns and
just is that uniform scratchy because okay. it's obviously wool. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of things that may seem insignificant, but they really make it tangible.
Right.
We've had a homebound volunteer who was asking what she could do to help our museum in the past. So what I had done in the past is we had found some pioneer patterns for girls' prairie dresses and bonnets, and we were looking for boys' cotton, unbleached, heavy cotton, like duck fabric and that. And we do have a dress-up box that Chris was actually talking to us earlier this week, is to be able to get that into a dress-up area that children can try on the prairie dress. Now, the thing is, what we did is we did because of maybe some limits that some children have. We did put Velcro on things so children can Velcro things on, because if you have a child with any kind of physical disability, they can't button buttons. But we do have some of those. We've taken some of the costumes that aren't permanent collection and brought them into the education collection. And so we've put a top hat in there. We have a straw hat like you would have seen the father in Little House on the Prairie in there, where it's the piece of straw that is braided together and then it's all sewn together in a hat. And so waistcoats. The only thing that's really hard for period things, and if you've been with the reenactors at the Civil War Museum, is shoes, because shoes, period shoes and that, or even reproduction period shoes, are really, really expensive. But what we do have done is we put a boot last out, which is the tool that you can pull a tall boot off without having to bend over and do it. We've put that out on in a hands-on area and have the kids take your shoes off by hooking your heel of your shoe or your boot in a boot last. So Chris has asked us as staff to think about what can we take from our dress-up box and incorporate into a hands-on program.
We want to bring that experience. It's all about experience and give these people, give our visitors what it would have been like back then, and give them a great interactive way of showing off what the history was like. And like you said, if you can touch it, if you can feel it, it's a little bit better than just looking at it, in our opinion.
And it's easier just to show something than try to verbally explain something. Like for the women at the Civil War Museum, it would be easier if you could pick out a corset piece and say, see, this has metal in it, this has whalebone in it, because the teachers talk about that stuff with children, but they really can't conceptualize it because they don't know what a whalebone is. They don't know what a corset is. They're used to elastic, they're used to Velcro, they're used to the modern stuff.
Well, we're getting down to about 12 minutes or so left, and I want to make sure we cover a couple of things. One of which is the Southport Lighthouse, which we've touched on. I've been doing weekends there for the last couple of years, and I've been really pleased by the experience, the engagement of the people who come there. I come from a maritime community, Marinette Menominee, and so I have a natural affiliation for that. But I like the fact that you are not just telling the story of the house and maybe the keepers, but you're going more and more into telling the maritime history that light station was very much a part of.
Correct, yeah. At the Southport Light Station Museum, what we really strive to do is tell the maritime history of Kenosha. Being such a important port in the state of Wisconsin, the industrial history of Kenosha centers around that port. With the SS Wisconsin going down 4 miles off the coast of Kenosha, we like to tell all those stories and not just the story of the lighthouse itself, because the purpose of that lighthouse was to guide those ships. So we do like to touch on that as well, and we think we do a pretty good job of that. This year we're very excited because we're actually just finalizing a loan that we're going to be receiving from the Wisconsin Maritime History Museum or Historical Society, and that's for the SS Wisconsin's binnacle. And the binnacle was actually the navigational tool off the ship. So right now we do have an SS Wisconsin room at the Southport Lighthouse Museum where we have had a past volunteer and current employee make a fantastic model.
Beautiful model.
It's every time I pass, and I looked at it again today, I just can't believe he did it. And I think what Ron said about it was that it's a three-year project that he did in about 6 months is how he puts it. But no, we're extremely excited to get this binnacle from the Maritime History Museum of Wisconsin and to get that installed for the opening this season. And we will be opening up May 3rd this year again. We run that seasonally May through October, October 30th being the last day of this season. And that's open Thursday through Sunday, Thursday through Saturday. Saturday we're open 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. and on Sunday we're open on at noon till 4 p.m. In addition to just the museum itself, we have a program called Light the Light at the Southport Lighthouse as well, and we do that year-round. And what people can do from the community and outside our community is that they can light the light in honor of someone or in memory of someone.
Or a special event like a high school group getting together in town for the reunions, they've lit things for that, anniversaries.
And what that is, you know, it's a great thing, first off, because it's just a great program and it's an interesting thing, but it's a great fundraiser for the museum also. And what we do is, you know, we light the light in honor of someone, and then they send a little small donation that helps us with our displays and with our ongoing restoration at the lighthouse. Just this year, we had to undertake a major project of doing some tuck pointing work to the tower. So, you know, last year, 2016 was our 150th year that the tower stood there, having been built in 1866. The Southport Lighthouse, the house itself, was built 1 year later in 1867. So this year we're actually celebrating the 150th anniversary of the house itself. So, it's a very interesting museum. If you haven't had a chance to come down, I really highly encourage coming down when we do open up for the season. And you'll probably have a chance to see Mike here if you come on the right day.
It's a great experience for somebody who is an interpreter in an exhibit like that, because the people who come are very interested. Many of them are quite knowledgeable. They recognize that that lighthouse station was a part of a system that covered the entire Great Lakes. It wasn't an isolated institution. But there is time to talk to everyone and answer all of their questions, because the volume is just right. It's not occasionally we have a very slow day, especially when cold weather or when the Packers are playing an important game. But otherwise, we have such a nice flow through there that you have time to spend with people and answer their questions and learn from them.
Oh, absolutely. And like you said, it's a great draw. Lighthouses are an interesting subject because you do get people that travel around, you know, the whole world really to view these lighthouses, ocean lighthouses, lake lighthouses. A lot of times what we run into in the summer is people that are doing the whole Lake Michigan loop. And there's quite a few lighthouses. I think it's over 100 lighthouses on Lake Michigan. And we get a chance to talk to quite a few people from around the country and around the world. And it's just a very interesting draw. And it's a draw that, you know, we like to have because we're drawing different people in. I would say last year, I think we probably had more people from outside of the community than inside the community come, just because.
I would say that's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then people did forget about that lighthouse because it was boarded up and the lantern room was taken off. And when we started doing work there in the 90s, people didn't remember it. It was remarkable, and now it's a feature of the community. People are very proud of their lighthouse.
Yeah, what's interesting about that one too is that the lighthouse was never electrified until we took it back over. So that lighthouse was decommissioned in 1906, and they were still using kerosene at that point. So when the Lighthouse Society that first was involved with the restoration, they started it. They did electrify the tower, and that's just something that's pretty interesting. The lantern room wasn't even on the tower for the longest time. If you had driven by in the 80s, it would have just been the tower itself without the lantern room on top of it. And as Sydney said,
looked like a smokestack.
Yeah, it looked like a smokestack. So people didn't even know that was a lighthouse.
So that leaves us with about 4 or 5 minutes to talk about another project that you're interested in having to do with the automobile thing and industry in Kenosha, and that is some oral history and some other projects having to do with the men and women of the industries of Kenosha, not just the Nashes, but the rank and file folks who lived and worked there.
Yeah, this is something that I've always been interested in since I began studying history, and there's always a saying, history is told from the side of the kings. You hear it from a king's perspective, or for us, on an industrial perspective for the Kenosha History Center, we've done a great job of telling the industrial history from the company's standpoint. However, we have not done such a great job of telling the story from the worker's standpoint. And that's something now in 2017 that we're almost backtracking on, and we want to get that history before it's gone. So obviously industry, a lot of that has left Kenosha, but the people that were working there, a lot of those people are still here. So, Mike, you had come in a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about it, and we are going to launch an oral history project here at the History Center where we want to get the workers' histories down on tape, on film, so that not only we can have access to that within our archives for next research, but also so that we can put that onto the floor and have it in forms of exhibits and having a worker talk to a visitor at the museum almost, so to give that experience.
Well, in about 2 minutes that we have left, is there anything that that you think we haven't covered that you'd really like to say?
Anniversary of Nash, first Nash Automobile. We have a big car show coming this summer in August. Chris is the big guy behind that, so he can tell you some details on that.
This year we run a AMC Homecoming Car Show every 3 years. That does fall this year, 2017. And like Cindy said, it falls in the 100th anniversary of Nash Automobiles. Nash came out with his first car in 1917. So this year that's going to be run the last week of July, July 25th through the 30th on Kennedy Park, or out at Kennedy Park, I should say. And that is the AMC Homecoming Car Show. Last time around in 2014, we had over 10,000 people from around the world come and visit us, and over 750 American Motors cars, and Nash cars are involved with that as well. So we're looking forward to that one. It's going to be another big hit this year, and looking forward to seeing all those cars parked out over at Kennedy again.
We've had people from Saudi Arabia. We've had returning people from Norway and Sweden. So they're coming from all over, and it's something to look very forward to. It's a lot of work for us, but the amount of people we have, it's great.
And the registration forms are available through our website, www.kenoshahistorycenter.org.
And people should realize that there is no charge for admission at the museum. Obviously, you accept donations and encourage them, but this is still a free museum. People from out of town constantly express amazement to me, whether I'm over at the Dinosaur Museum or whatever, that we have all these free museums in Kenosha.
We do, and people from Chicago are shocked that they can park for free, too.
Yeah, so with that, we'll have to wrap it up. This is the end of today's Education Matters. My name is Mike Keough. I've been here with Cynthia Nelson, the Curator of Collections at the Kenosha History Center, and Chris Allen, the Executive Director. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us.
And thanks for having us, Mike.
I think it'll be about a month before I'm back here, but there'll be somebody else in this chair next week, and please join us.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
And that, of course, is the theme song for the Mary Tyler Moore Show, who passed away this past Wednesday, the 25th of January. The show, which centered on Richard's work as a producer in a fictional Minneapolis newsroom and her life as a single woman, earned 29 Emmy Awards. Mary Tyler Moore, a type 1 diabetic, was a passionate advocate for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. On June 24th, the WGTD Radio Theater will feature our own version of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and we do so in memory of Mary Tyler Moore, who truly turned the world on with her beautiful smile.